Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Oncology Grand Rounds. We're really excited to be here today and talk about new developments in GI cancers. Well, here's what we're going to focus on today. First, we're going to start out with what I think is one of the most, if not the most exciting development in GI cancers, and that has been the use of the regimen of atezolizumab, the checkpoint inhibitor, plus bevacizumab to treat hepatocellular cancer. But we're also going to talk about how that affects just the treatment of HCC in general. Then we're going to talk about the management of metastatic colorectal cancer. You know, we could talk for a long time about localized disease adjuvant therapy, but there's a lot of action going on in metastatic disease. And in particular, we wanted to, getting into this theme of why decisions are being made. One thing about colorectal cancers, we're seeing biomarkers coming in to help influence decisions. We're going to talk about that. Many of the cancers that we're going to talk about in this series, biomarkers are very important in making treatment decisions. Lung cancer is a good example where the therapy is really determined by a bunch of biomarkers that is done. Then we're going to talk about metastatic gastric cancer, the use of checkpoint inhibitors, and some other things related to gastric cancer, including the use of anti-HER therapy. And then finally, if we have time, we're going to chat a little bit about managing patients, including GI patients, in the era of COVID. I'm going to share with you the results of a survey that we did that we sent to you, to the registrants, about what's going on at your centers across the country as it relates to COVID. So let's start out now talking about hepatocellular cancer. And Philip, I was just sort of reflecting back on the beginning of this year. You know, every year in the beginning of the year, usually in January, there's a so-called ASCO GI meeting. And we did this symposium at ASCO GI on hepatocellular cancer. And it was at the end of January. And of course, you know, we're always asking people, how do you treat patients, et cetera. And we sent out a survey to 25 investigators, and we said, you know, what's your first-line therapy, you know, a bunch of things about what they do. But a couple weeks before that, we were doing another meeting, and actually Philip was one of the faculty people there, and one of the topics was HCC, and we had a poll there, and we sent it out and said, you know, what's your usual first therapy for hepatocellular cancer? Because there had been a big debate between sorafenib and lenvatinib, two tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so just before we started the meeting, I looked down and I see that Philip, as well as the other docs, wrote in a different answer we didn't even know about, which was atezo-bev. And we're going to talk about this really interesting story. And in fact, when we asked the investigators, what's your usual first-line therapy, whereas 2 months before they were saying sorafenib or lenvatinib, they switched. And so this is not just about HCC. It's about when does research show you some answers that make you change what you do, like on a dime. And for example, these are the way that our oncologists were responding to the same question a couple weeks before that. You don't even see that option. Again, they were choosing between TKIs. And you can see, again, what happened with the experts. I'm just going to sort of flip through these and just stop for a second and just, you know, take a breath and ask Philip to talk a little bit about this, how this story evolved. Essentially, there was a meeting called ESMO Asia that I never even heard about where this paper was presented. Philip, we're going to take a look at some of the data, but I'm just, maybe you can reflect a little bit about kind of your thoughts when you first saw the results of this trial.
So basically, this trial really proved a few things that we knew about the disease. Number one, immunotherapy can work in this disease. So atezo is a PD-L1 inhibitor, but by itself, as we know, the immunotherapy, although produces benefit in some patients, durable benefit, but the majority of the patients do not get as much benefit. And then add to it another drug called bevacizumab, which is an anti-angiogenesis drug, which we knew that these tumors have high vascularity, so it makes sense to use a drug like bevacizumab. Putting them together really resulted in some form of synergy that improved the outcome if you compare it to treating with either drug alone. And in fact, the study showed improvement in all the parameters that you and I would like to see to really deem something being very active, like response rate, the shrinkage, like the duration of response, and survival obviously is very important. And then there is some underlying science that explains this, which I can just mention that the bevacizumab probably does something to the microenvironment or the environment within the tumor that makes immunotherapy work better.
And again, we're going to talk more about this advance. You know, this is not the cure of HCC. It's just an important advance that's going to make a big difference to patients. And also want to walk you through a few questions that sort of lead you into what we're going to talk about with HCC. So one, in terms of what's actually FDA approved, because actually Atezobev is not FDA approved at this point, although I think people are using it and they're able to use it because both of the drugs are approved. But Melanie, up until now, we've been using tyrosine kinase inhibitors up front, sorafenib, and more recently, lenvatinib. Now we're moving to checkpoint inhibitor and bevacizumab, as Philip said. And one of the differences is side effects. And just wonder if you could reflect on what you've seen over the years, Melanie, in terms of particularly sorafenib. It kind of has a reputation of not being that easy a drug to use in these patients.
Sure. I think a lot of the patients that I have seen really struggle with fatigue as a primary adverse event or side effect. We do a lot of dose reductions for that tolerability, you know, not being able to do activities of daily living, not being able to get out and exercise due to fatigue. In addition, we also see some laboratory changes. So neutropenia, of course, or thrombocytopenia we have seen, and also have to make dose reductions dependent on those values. Nausea and diarrhea also being very common symptoms that we see in side effects of the drug.
So we'll talk a little bit more about these drugs because they're still being used. I mean, Atezobev is not the cure of HCC that I know of. And so people go on to get second and third line therapy. And Wells, you know, we see this in lots of cancers that there's a sort of a sequence of agents or therapies that are used on incurable metastatic situations. And we'll talk about how these other ones are starting to fit in now that a lot of people are thinking about Atezobev. But let's talk a little bit about this regimen and sort of why it is that we switched over so quickly. Can you talk a little bit, Wells, about kind of what the regimen is and what's involved in delivering it?
Sure. So many of the other agents you mentioned are pills, and this is a completely IV regimen. The patients only need to come in every 3 weeks, so it's fairly convenient. And one thing that comes up with pills, especially ones that are very expensive, is they tend to come out of a different part of the patient's insurance. And so you might have a patient where it's covered, but they have a $500 copay, which for a lot of patients is a real struggle. And unfortunately, I think with this COVID thing, with our economy, that struggle is going to become a lot more difficult for patients. So the fact that pills have those copays, deductibles, and donuts can really affect whether or not patients can take it. And as Melanie said, there's a bunch of side effects with those, and many patients just have such severe side effects when they start that other doses have been explored, at least to start with, and I know we'll talk about that. But they're very easy to give. They're fairly quick infusions. And most oncologists have a lot of experience, and nurses, I think, also have experience with these two agents. And so it's a very, you know, convenient, fairly easy regimen to give. And I think that's why you've seen such quick uptake.
Yeah, because you don't often see, you know, new developments where not only you have better efficacy, but better tolerability. And you're right, that's probably a big part of the reason. Tammy, any comments? I know that you have actually quite a bit of experience with this regimen, although, again, it was just published. Any comments about sort of some of the issues that you run into in patients on this regimen?
So in the past couple months, we put on, I'd say in a 10-month period, we probably put on 10 patients on this regimen. They're getting prior auths, even though pre-approved, even though it's not FDA approved. I have to say, this is totally changing the landscape of HCC. Patients are tolerating it quite well. Maybe a little bit of fatigue for a day or two after, but generally really well tolerated. Some blood pressure issues, as usual with Bev, but really a different conversation with HCC patients when it comes to treatment.
So let's talk a little bit about the trial itself that was done and, you know, why the results have changed so much what's being done. So Philip, this is what we call a phase 3 trial. And maybe even before you talk about what this trial shows, just maybe briefly comment on what a phase 3 trial is as opposed to a phase 1 and 2 that would typically precede something like this.
Basically, a phase 3 trial is a study that is done prospectively in a randomized fashion. Why is it randomized? Because we need to know a new treatment, is it different than the existing standard treatment? In this case, the trial is phase 3 because it was randomized and a third of the patients received what we call the control arm, received what is the standard treatment then, which is sorafenib. And then 2/3 of the patients were randomized to receive the experimental treatment. So in building up or coming to the point where you do a phase 3 trial, you really have to have some data of the experimental regimen, in this case, atezo and bevacizumab, that is interesting enough to proceed to a phase 3 trial, because phase 3 trial is a major undertaking, a lot of expense which goes with it, cost, and therefore you don't want to put so many patients into a study that really doesn't have a good chance of being positive. In this case, the pilot trials which were done initially of the combination were very interesting. So that takes you into the phase 2, which is the phase 2 that leads to the phase 3, so pilot trials. And then phase 1 is when you're trying to see whether the drugs really are safe. So the safety goes through phase 1, and then initial look at the efficacy or benefit and safety goes into phase 2, and then ultimately you have to say that, yes, I can say this new regimen is better than what I've been using as a standard treatment. And that's exactly what happened here. Sorafenib was a standard treatment, and the combination did better. And that led to people adopting the use of the combination because it was better than the standard of care, which is sorafenib. And this is exactly what a phase 3 trial does.
And we're going to show the results of this in a second. And Wells, in a second, I want to ask you typically what the situation would be when you're thinking about systemic therapy of HCC, because there are other means to treat it. Surgery, you can remove it. You can do transplant. You can do intrahepatic therapy. But before we get into that, getting back to the trial issue, Tammy, I'm curious how patients respond to the idea of being randomized. You know, they go in and, maybe there's an exciting development and this sparks a trial like that. You would think a lot of patients would want to go on the experiment and not want to be randomized to sort of the control arm. I wonder if you run into that issue when people consider phase 3 trials. Tammy, on the other hand, they have the opportunity to get a therapy maybe they wouldn't get, but they could get randomized to sort of control. How do patients respond to that?
I think there's a mix. I think when there's excitement about a new therapy, of course, people are very anxious about getting randomized to that arm, especially when one of those arms is immunotherapy with all the commercials and media. So when they're not, they're very, disappointed about that. But it's just a par for the course and takes a lot of emotional support through that.
And some of the trials, though, build in the fact that you could receive the experimental therapy later. I don't know that that was the case here, but that sometimes can mollify those issues. So, Wells, again, getting back to the point at which you're thinking about systemic therapy, maybe you can talk about some of these other strategies that are used. And when is it that you decide, we need to use systemic therapy?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that I really pay attention to, and we have a weekly multidisciplinary liver conference where we have our transplant surgeons as well as our surgical oncologists, interventional radiology, hepatology, et cetera. But first thing I focus on is I do not want to ruin the chance for a transplant. Especially if you're a younger patient, the main thing you do not want to do is do a biopsy, because many programs will refuse to do a transplant on a patient if you've done a biopsy due to concerns about seeding the tumor in other areas of the body. So if it's a younger patient, especially 50s or below, if they're in good health, if the AFP is greater than 200 or greater than 400, depending on the guidelines, and it has classical imaging characteristics for an HCC, I do not biopsy that patient until I talk to a hepatologist or a transplant surgeon, because I really don't want to make that mistake, because those patients can live for decades with the liver transplant. So that's job one.
Before you go on, could you just clarify what AFP is?
Sure. So AFP is alpha fetoprotein, which is the classic tumor marker for HCC. Not all of them have a high AFP, but if they do and you have what's called a washout on the imaging, sort of a classic appearance that the radiologist will tell you, you really don't have to biopsy those patients and you can simply treat them. Now, of course, you may want to get biomarkers for a trial down the line. So once they're not a transplant candidate, then I might say, okay, we're going to go ahead and do the biopsy because we want to find out this molecular information. But I just avoid doing that until I make sure that my transplant hepatologist has taken a look. And if you have one lesion less than 5 or 6 centimeters or 3 lesions less than 3 centimeters, and you also get points for the amount of cirrhosis you have, that patient might be a transplant candidate. And we're also doing liver donor transplants. We do over 120 in our program, either cadaver or living donor transplants. So that's sort of the main thing to start with. Then after that, to be honest with you, I'm often trying to make sure the interventional radiologists are kind of looking at the big picture, because I often find in second opinions, they're not doing scans of the lungs, for instance. And so they'll do taste, taste, and then suddenly there'll be some lung nodules. And had they looked, you know, before, you have to make sure that you're kind of looking at the big picture, because everyone kind of focuses on their area. But there's certainly a role for transarterial therapy. And if you can shrink a solitary lesion, you may take a patient who is not a transplant candidate and make them a transplant candidate. So again, having that transplant evaluation for a younger patient is critical. Of course, once it's widespread, then you're really thinking more about systemic therapy. And what I'm trying to do in our program, to be honest with you, because sorafenib was the only drug for so long, and the hepatologists and folks would say, that doesn't work all that well. It's so toxic. I see patients, they can't walk. And as Melanie said, they're tired. They've got diarrhea. Why are we going to send to medical oncology? Why bother? You know, we should just do what we're going to do and then send them to hospice or something. That's totally changed, because now we've got all these newer therapies. Immunotherapy, when it works, it can work for long periods of time. So what I'm finding that we're doing in our program is really educating our interventional radiologists, our hepatologists, and ultimately the patients, to let them know that, no, we've got all these newer drugs and targeted therapies, and they're well tolerated. The cost benefit is much better for patients. And so I think it's important to think about systemic therapy earlier than we have in years past.
So, Philip, can you talk a little bit more about TACE and other intrahepatic treatments for HCC and how you decide? You know, before, I don't think sorafenib shrunk tumors too much. You know, people stayed stable. Now you have this new therapy that they actually shrink. But can you talk a little bit about how you decide between whether you're going to use therapy that's directed at the liver as opposed to systemic? I mean, obviously, you have a metastatic disease, but assuming it's in the liver, how do you decide which way to go, Phil?
So if it's in the liver, in my practice, in our practice, the first thing we think of is liver-directed therapy, unless the disease is too extensive, for example, involving one of the major portal veins. Otherwise, we would like to consider first liver-directed therapy, because liver-directed therapy has basis. These tumors you see in the liver, and as Wells mentioned, some of them have the appearance of having a lot of vascularity in them. You can use that aspect in terms of treating them, because what it really means is that those tumors like to suck the blood from the arterial system, the hepatic artery. And the normal liver cells require less of the blood from the arterial system, so there's some differential. Therefore, if you give something through the hepatic artery, it will go and kill the cancer cells preferentially. So TACE, for example, transarterial chemoembolization, uses chemotherapy and some embolizing material. Radioembolization uses small glass beads type thing, which is covered by radioactivity, so using radioactivity there. And some people also use blunt embolization, which is just trying to clog the artery. So these treatments, I use them obviously only if the disease is limited to the liver, and only if there is limited to the liver, but also it's safe to do it. So if there's a blockage of the portal vein, then it's not safe to do it, and those patients don't do well anyway. And those patients are the ones that I go for systemic treatment. If the disease has extrahepatic metastases, for example, in the lungs, in the lymph nodes, in the mesentery, those patients, I will not do liver-directed therapy, and I will go to a systemic treatment, which will be, at this point in time, the frontline treatment we discussed, atezo and bevacizumab. Some patients may have bone metastases. Again, I mean, if you have metastatic disease, extrahepatic disease, I will not do liver-directed therapy. If you have major portal vein thrombosis or invasion, I will not do liver-directed therapy. Only I will do it in patients who have really, truly limited. Which takes me to one point, which is a very important point. Over the last 2 years, I've been involved with an organization that's looking into the management of HCC, mainly in community hospitals. And HCC is not a common tumor, and therefore, with the more advances we have made in diagnostics and treatment, localized treatment, transplant, newer treatments, it's very important that these patients are discussed in a multidisciplinary manner where they're experts, because it's very easy to really not follow what would be the logical way of treating those patients.
So, Tammy, we were talking about liver-directed therapy and their various types. Just kind of curious how you see people tolerating that.
Fairly well. It's rare that I have a patient that doesn't do well. chemoembolization versus radioembolization. Sometimes there could be a little bit more fatigue with radioembolization. For the most part, I speak to my patients in a very positive tone that people do really well for the first week or two. Some fatigue, some people could have some nausea, appetite loss. We actually used to see all these people 2 weeks after their procedure, do labs, and through the years we found that they ended up being pretty uneventful visits because everyone was doing so well. So we stopped bringing them back so frequently. So generally, they do fairly well. It's rare that someone has a major complication. You know, fever, abscess can be an issue. I think in the past 13 years, I think there was one patient that I could think of. So really infrequent serious complications.
So let's talk a little bit more about the trial that we've been talking about, the Atezo-Bev trial, and particularly what the findings were. And then we're going to actually hear of a really interesting case of a patient who was treated with that. So Wells, we mentioned the fact that this is a randomized study. So they either got standard of care, which is sorafenib, or the new regimen. Can you talk about what the results were here? You see there's a difference in that people are less likely to relapse, so that's who survived, and they're less likely to die. So the Atezo-Bev is the light green at the top, and as opposed to the other one. Can you talk about what your thoughts were about the results of the study, Wells?
Yeah, so, you know, when I'm looking at survival curves, I'm really paying a lot of attention to that HR, that hazard ratio, and also looking at the medians. But the nice thing about hazard ratio is it captures the difference between the outcomes of both groups along the entire curve. Because the median is just where you're at the 50% range. So sometimes those medians will pinch in and the curve will kind of come together. And so there's not much difference. Or other times they'll bubble out. And so the medians kind of give you just that snapshot at the 50% mark. But the hazard ratio captures the whole curve. And you want them to be less than one, because one means they're equivalent. If it's greater than one, it means there's a greater hazard of something, either hazard of death or progression. So you like to see it less than one. And if you put this in the context of, you know, for instance, colorectal cancer, adding bevacizumab in the second line setting, or, you know, some of the other drugs we use, a lot of those hazard ratios are 0.8, meaning there's only a 20% difference. Here you're seeing them below 0.6. They're in the 0.5 range. So you're seeing a greater than 40% improvement in survival and progression-free survival, which, you know, granted, we're not curing people. We'd love it if we did, but it's actually fairly impressive and it's a fairly sizable advantage. And to see a curve for liver cancer after, you know, you think about, we had, what, 100 negative trials, Philip, before sorafenib even came out, to see a survival curve where they don't even reach the median overall survival, i.e. it doesn't, that green line to the left doesn't cross 0.5. That's a really impressive result. It also tells you why we need to have a contemporaneous control group, though, because the sorafenib group did better than the historical sorafenib trial. And so sometimes people will say, well, why do we need a randomized trial? We can just use the old comparator. The reason is because with improved imaging and supportive care and all the rest, the control group tends to do much better than historically. And also remember, half of randomized trials are negative. So half the time, you're getting side effects with no benefit. So there are many trials, and I think Philip was quite involved in this. You know, SWOG published a review of all the studies that have been done, and sometimes the negative trials are the ones that help you the most because you're not giving expensive, harmful therapies to people who aren't going to benefit. So sometimes learning what not to do is as important as learning, you know, what to do. And of course, a big issue is whether or not they have crossover. Are you able to cross over to the active group, which is another conversation that we have with patients? I think a trial like this, would I put a patient on a study like this? Sure, because I know I have access to immunotherapy in the second line setting. So I'd be pretty comfortable putting on a study like this. And you can see, you know, the side effects were actually fairly well tolerated also. We'll get to that.
Yeah, we can take a look at the side effects. As again, you know, you don't often see a trial where not only do you see improved benefit, and incidentally, what you were talking about with the hazard rate is another theme that goes through this whole series, because in many cancers, that's really the number you want to focus on. But it looks like there are a lot more problems in the sorafenib group. Melanie, if you could comment a little bit on, you know, sort of the tolerability differences clinically between giving a TKI compared to, say, giving something like Bev and Atezo-Bev.
Sure. I think Tammy really touched on this as well, and I completely agree. The Atezo-Bev, in terms of tolerability, some patients don't even know that they're receiving these agents. And just sometimes they would joke that they didn't feel like they were getting a treatment because they felt so well. And we have to sort of give them that support that, you know, till their first scan, that we don't know if they're receiving benefit yet, but it doesn't mean that they're not, because they're not experiencing such side effects as they did with the other agents and certainly sorafenib. So in terms of tolerability, they're amazing. That's why people ask us and want to know, you know, why they're not receiving or can they receive, because their lives can be, you know, relatively close to normal with other chemotherapy agents they aren't. So less fatigue, certainly less nausea, no diarrhea, unless you get into the inflammation, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But from a day-to-day perspective, they're really tolerating these drugs quite well.
So I want Tammy to present a case here, the 63-year-old patient, and to me, it's really an incredible case. I'm really curious to see what you all think about it. Very unusual case. So, Tammy, what happened with this patient?
This was a pretty unique case. I never thought we'd be talking about HCC in this aspect. So he was a 63-year-old, healthy guy, living his life, presented to the ER with right upper quadrant abdominal pain and was diagnosed with a large liver mass. This led to his Hep C diagnosis. He previously was not diagnosed with Hep C. And a follow-up MRI showed a 10-centimeter hepatic mass. He did have some smaller satellite lesions. And then he also had a 4.5-centimeter adrenal met. AFP was 193, and he had a normal CA19-9. Referring to what Wells was saying, its characteristics on MRI and, you know, a rise in his AFP. He actually did end up getting a biopsy because they wanted to confirm the adrenal met.
Before you go on, Tammy, just backtrack a little bit, Philip. It was mentioned that this man actually had Hep C, didn't realize it. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what the diseases are in the liver that typically lead to HCC, including Hep C, Hep B, but also NASH?
So there are two things, or at least two things, that result in a cancer in the liver. One is viral infection. It can do it by itself, even without producing the typical cirrhosis, but usually it does it through cirrhosis. And hepatitis C infection is the commonest one that we see in the Western world. In the Asian countries, they can see more of the hepatitis B, except for Japan, which is hepatitis C. The other one is having, like, people who have alcohol abuse, so that leads to cirrhosis, inflammation, regeneration of tissues, and then DNA mutation and a cancer can develop. And more recently, over the last two or three decades, we have recognized that, especially in the Western world, obesity, increased body mass index, and all that have really resulted in an association with development of HCC, because there's a lot of deposition of fat inside the liver, and for some reason that also results in some sort of inflammation. That's why we call it NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And that's another reason why people can get the cancer, irrespective of whether they have hepatitis C or A or B infection. And by the way, we're not talking about hepatitis A. The bottom line here is that in a patient like this, he wasn't diagnosed with the Hep C earlier. If he was diagnosed with the Hep C earlier and he was discovered to have the cirrhosis, usually they lead to the cirrhosis, he would have ended up on a surveillance program and maybe his disease would have been diagnosed at an earlier stage. And as Wells was saying, like a stage where he can do transplant or even resection of the tumor.
That's a really good point in terms of screening patients with cirrhosis. But the other issue that comes up, it came up in this case, is actually treating and hopefully curing the Hep C.
Yeah.
Any comments, Philip?
In patients who have a disease like he has now, at least in our center, we do not give them anti-hepatitis C treatment because obviously it's too late now. He already developed the cancer. But I would like to also hear what Wells does in his own institution.
Yeah, it's the same thing for us. Actually, it's often an insurance issue. So the reason to treat hepatitis C is to prevent further inflammation and progression of cirrhosis and development of it. So if you develop metastatic disease, it can be tricky. I have had a few patients who've done really well with localized therapy. And so a couple of years later, we're able to go back to insurance and say, look, you know, this person's doing very well. We think we should treat it, but that is an issue. And the other interesting thing is now that more and more hepatitis C is being treated, the thinking is that fewer people will actually die from cirrhosis. So ironically, the HCC rate might end up going up, or at least the number of cases, because you won't have people dying of as many competing causes, which is end-stage cirrhosis.
Wow, that's really interesting. So going back to this case, so I guess this patient actually got put on a trial. I mean, talk about benefits of clinical trial. This patient got atezo-bev 2 years ago on a clinical trial. What happened there, Tammy?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the hep C. Our institution practices that same way. We don't treat hep C during an active liver cancer. Of note, this patient had responded to his clinical trial, to his treatment, and didn't get his hep C treated probably until almost a year into therapy. And he had such long disease control that then the hepatologist agreed to treat his hep C upon his insistence as well. But traditionally, we don't treat hep C either with an active cancer. So he started on trial, tolerated it very well. His first restaging scan, he had decreasing liver and adrenal lesion, which you could see his adrenal lesion is not there anymore. I do want to note that before people have their first scan, I always warn them that many times we may not see their disease shrinking at that first scan, and sometimes we can even have some slight hyperprogression. And so I always like to warn people ahead of time so they're not disappointed at that first scan when they don't see that their disease is shrinking. So he stayed on treatment for, you know, a year and a half, had a great response, that adrenal met, melted away. We had to discontinue his bevacizumab for proteinuria. Probably, I mean, he was on it for a good year or more already. And then one of his satellite lesions actually started growing by a few millimeters. So after a lot of discussion with surgeons, with the patient, he really wanted to pursue a surgery to resect his cancer. So he ended up going through a surgery, had a hepatectomy, a right adrenalectomy. The adrenal gland had no evidence of cancer in it on path. And he is currently on surveillance, living his life, getting scans every 3 months.
So, you know, of course, when you ask people to present cases, they often will pick a very unusual or interesting case. And we're not saying this is a typical example of HCC. I never even heard of somebody with HCC, you know, having this kind of course where they get surgery, et cetera. But I think more from a macro perspective as well, it just, you know, points out the potential benefit of this new regimen, which now I guess we're seeing beginning to move through.
Neil brings up an interesting point, which is when do you stop? And this is one thing that I've struggled with, and you and I have talked about before, and I'm sure Tammy, you struggled with this too, but you know, especially when patients are on these trials and they're doing really well and you are able to take them to surgery, do you stop at that point? Because now you're almost on a curative paradigm. It gets very challenging because many times the patients are really nervous about stopping this, what they consider sort of a miraculous therapy. And yet it has incredible economic implications for our healthcare system.
And now, you know, coming into the hospital, when people don't want to be coming into the hospital is another consideration. People are starting to stretch out intervals between therapy. We could talk about this for a long time, but let's move on now and talk about our next subject. I think it'll be equally interesting, which is the management of metastatic colorectal cancer. And we want to go through a few of the issues that relate to making the decision about how do you begin therapy in a patient with metastatic colorectal cancer. So we're going to go through a couple of things that we're going to talk about. And one thing that's kind of come out, Philip, in recent years that I was really surprised when I first started to hear it, was the difference between tumors that start in the left side of the colon versus the right side in terms of how you treat them with metastatic disease. So it seemed kind of counterintuitive. Phil, maybe you can just sort of tell that story a little bit about what we learned. It seems almost like they're two different diseases.
Well, not only two different diseases, Neil, but two different probably organs, because if you look at the pathology and molecular pathology, there are differences between the right side and the left side. And if you look at the way cancers are diagnosed, it's a bit of a different thing, because I don't know if you know that using colonoscopy is more helpful on the left side than on the right side. And there are reasons for that. So you're dealing with two different organs in many ways, going back to embryology and also the molecular makeup. For that reason, we learned over the last 10 years that right-sided colon tumors don't do as well on chemotherapy when they have metastatic disease compared to left-sided colon tumors, but also they don't respond the same. So basically we have like bevacizumab, we use it in adding it to chemotherapy. We know the benefit. And we also have the anti-EGFR drugs, monoclonal antibodies, and this includes the panitumumab and the cetuximab. And the studies have shown that the anti-EGFR drugs tend to work much better in the left side than they do on the right side. So for that reason, what we've been doing for a long time, which is adding bevacizumab to chemotherapy, we've been continuing to do that, especially on the right side and also on the left side. But there's also the opportunity to use the anti-EGFR drugs on the left side, which also work in addition to chemotherapy. So there's a distinction in terms of the biological behavior. There's a separation in terms of the molecular profile. There are some mutations that are more prevalent on one side than the other. Just to give an example, MSI, microsatellite instability, is seen more on the right side, the tumors. The BRAF mutations, which we will be discussing later on, also are seen more on the right side tumors, and so on. So there is difference in the biology, and they look like the same organ, but not exactly the same. So there's differences between the two.
So, Melanie, one of the issues about, you know, we were just talking about EGFR antibodies, so cetuximab and panitumumab, and, you know, trying to identify patients who won't benefit. We talked about right side, but also we talked about molecular profiling, and we know that there's molecular profiles, specifically so-called RAS mutations, where people don't respond. I'm just kind of curious what your experience is with side effects of EGFR antibodies, because they are some of the more difficult anti-cancer therapies to utilize. And, you know, by avoiding them when they're not going to help people, you're avoiding toxicity. Any comments about what you've observed with these EGFR antibodies?
Sure. I mean, one of the main ones we use a lot, I think a primary side effect I've seen is rash, which can be really bothersome, really hard to control at times. We often elicit derm if we need them. But, you know, they've been around for so long that we do have a treatment plan in place and patients can respond, but obviously it's hard for them to walk around in their daily life having rash all over their face and their body, et cetera. Diarrhea being another one that we see. And again, we can adjust and give meds and, you know, we talk about that consistently in visits, but can lead to more complications, dehydration, things like that.
So, Wells, you know, Philip referred to BRAF mutation, particularly V600E, and we know from melanoma for a long time now that these will respond to targeted therapy. And we've known that you see these mutations in patients with colorectal cancer, but for a long time, it looked like the BRAF inhibitors wouldn't work. And it wasn't until they started to be combined with other agents that we started to see some pretty significant efficacy. Wells, can you just sort of provide an overview of that? We put a couple questions in the poll about that, which we'll show as Wells talks.
Yeah, absolutely. So BRAF V600E, it's the most common BRAF mutation. It actually used to be called 599 because it was counted by hand back in the day, and it was mislabeled. The poor postdoc who had to count the 600 codons there. But it's in about 8 to 15% of colorectal cancer patients. As Phil said, it's more on the right side. And when that BRAF is mutated, the kinase is 500 times more active. So it's signaling 500-fold more than it's supposed to be. So you can see why it would sort of drive the biology of a tumor. It tends to be mutually exclusive with RAS mutations. So in other words, once you have a short circuit, there really isn't a selection pressure for additional signaling down the pathway. But even early on, it was noted that colorectal cancer cell lines, and my colleague at MD Anderson, Scott Kopetz, has shown a lot of this, that colorectal cancer cell lines, even BRAF mutated, don't respond to BRAF inhibition the same way that melanoma does. And it sort of challenged this idea that was kind of popular about a decade ago that we could get rid of caring about whether someone had melanoma or breast cancer or colon. All we had to do is molecular testing and we'd know what to do. Well, it turns out that the context of the tumor actually is important. Might not be important for NTRK. It might not be important for MSI-high, for instance, but seems to be important in BRAF. And there are so many ways in which the signaling pathway can go around. So in other words, you block with a middle linebacker and the pathway just goes along the side, basically. So when you block BRAF and colorectal cancer cell lines, you get increased signaling to ARAF and CRAF, for instance. So it became clear that even preclinically, even in the lab, that a combination approach was going to be needed. And it turns out that if you use a BRAF inhibitor in colorectal, you have upregulation of the EGFR pathway, and therefore it made sense to combine with either cetuximab or panitumumab to try to cut off that signaling around the inhibition. And we'll talk about the Beacon trial in some of your later slides.
So yeah, in terms of the approach, now it looks like either two or three drugs. And Philip, in melanoma, we saw this combination of encorafenib, binimetinib, that seem to be very effective. Can you talk a little bit about right now what the common treatments are for BRAF mutant colorectal cancer?
As Wells was saying, using the encorafenib alone isn't going to really work in this situation. So we have to combine it with another agent. And the first one that really comes to mind is combining with an anti-EGFR drug, because that's where the feedback is leading to increased signaling. So the combination of encorafenib with an anti-EGFR drug, and the study was done with cetuximab. And also they had the triplet with the binimetinib, which is a MEK/ERK inhibitor. However, at this point in time, it's really not clear how much benefit you have by having three drugs versus two drugs. And in my practice, I've been using the encorafenib with cetuximab, and that's what the FDA has approved for the use of treatment in this BRAF V600 mutated patients. There's also work done by Dr. Kopetz, and he had another trial which had three drugs in it, and that trial had the BRAF inhibitor plus the cetuximab, but also he used chemotherapy. In that case, it was irinotecan. So we have really two strategies here. One is using the triplet using irinotecan plus anti-BRAF and anti-EGFR, or using the anti-EGFR and BRAF combination. So these are the two options. In my practice myself, I've been using the encorafenib plus the cetuximab in this situation. In some patients, I use panitumumab because I don't think it makes a difference to use either one of them. The clinical trial was done with cetuximab, but you can also use panitumumab every 2 weeks. So that's been my experience. And the point here is that patients have to be tested, obviously, for the mutation. In my practice, I do the mutational analysis. We do the whole genomic next gen sequencing in our patients. As soon as we have someone who's diagnosed with stage 4 disease, either de novo or someone who had earlier stage and had a recurrence, we always do the genomic profiling, so we have that information. Now, the targeting of the BRAF with these combinations is now in the second line, because the trials were in the second line after failure of the primary treatment or first-line treatment. There's also now work being done to test the use of the BRAF strategy, which I just mentioned, in the frontline treatment before you treat them with anything else.
So we're going to present a couple cases, but we just kind of maybe run through a few other issues, or you know, kind of this survey of sort of what's new in metastatic colorectal cancer. And Melanie, another issue that comes up has to do, once patients kind of get through their initial therapies, first, second line chemotherapy, chemobiologic therapy, you know, what's coming next? And the two drugs that have been used in this scenario have been TAS-102 and regorafenib. We've been talking about this the last couple of years. Just maybe you can reflect, Melanie, on your experience with these two drugs, TAS-102, regorafenib, in the sort of post-second-line chemotherapy or sometimes even later in terms of tolerability, Melanie.
Sure. In our clinic specifically, you know, we do have a lot of clinical trials. So these drugs often are used kind of further down the line. They'll go on a clinical trial and then potentially those are sort of in reserve for the oncologist, has been my experience. And Wells, you can also comment on that. But, you know, again, with tolerability, I think both regorafenib and TAS are difficult for patients, and including fatigue, diarrhea, having to sort of manage those side effects consistently every time we see the patient. And then laboratory abnormalities, some neutropenia, thrombocytopenia.
Of course, there's been a lot of discussion in recent years, Philip, about dosing of regorafenib, because initially when full dose was used, these patients had lots of problems. Can you talk a little bit about TAS-102, Philip? What I've been hearing is in general, it's well tolerated in terms of sort of quality of life issues, although it can cause neutropenia. What exactly is TAS-102, Philip?
TAS-102 is an anti-metabolite. So think of it like drugs we have, for example, 5-fluorouracil. These are nucleotide metabolism inhibitors, and therefore they reduce the synthesis of the building blocks that you need for your DNA, and therefore the cell is unable to continue with its process of either proliferation or trying to withstand the insults that happen to the DNA, which we do in order to kill the tumor cells. So basically, these drugs work best by giving them on a continuous basis. So like the 5-fluorouracil, when we transform from giving a bolus to continuous infusion to get a better control over the growth of the cancer cell, these drugs being oral really fulfill that sort of model where the patient takes it for 5 days, there's a break for 2 days, and takes another 5 days, trying to really nicely and gently put a break on the growth of the tumor. by doing that, don't expect that they're going to reduce the size of the tumor. And that's one of the things about these types of drugs. They're good in the static way, keeping the tumor static, but they're not very good in trying to shrink it down, which is really what we often like to see. But then again, if we keep something static, it helps the patient to not go into the next phase, which is the cancer getting worse and worse and getting more symptoms. One of the side effects is neutropenia. And in fact, the studies have shown that the neutropenia is also a predictor of how well the tumor will respond to the treatment. So it's some sort of a biomarker, if you want. It's a pharmacodynamic biomarker. The good thing is that the neutropenia is not really that dangerous in these situations. When you have a drug like TAS-102 causes neutropenia, it's oftentimes been in many ways sort of benign, if you would, because you're not really having other factors on top of it to really increase the risk of the patient to get sepsis. If you give, like, for example, another drug on top of it that can cause mucositis, damage to the lining of the colon or somewhere else, that by itself invites bacteria to go inside the bloodstream or into the body. And if you have a low neutrophil count, leads to sepsis. But with the TAS-102, that is unlikely to happen.
And you can see in the trial where TAS-102 was compared to placebo that the patients did somewhat better. Of course, it's almost end-of-life care, so you don't see a huge difference where it's being used. But Wells, another development, you know, seeing more and more adding in anti-angiogenics. You were talking before about adding bevacizumab to atezolizumab. You see a lot of trials using anti-angiogenics, whether it's bevacizumab or others, to checkpoint inhibitors. Here we see bevacizumab, and of course, bevacizumab has been added to chemotherapy. Any thoughts about this study, Wells, adding bevacizumab to TAS-102?
Well, it sort of continues this theme we've seen, really even since the early days of bevacizumab, which showed efficacy when given with 5-FU. There's something about anti-metabolite and bevacizumab combination that seems to work well. So for instance, we use 5-FU or capecitabine in combination with bevacizumab as a maintenance regimen, as per the Cairo trials. This is a fairly small study, but it did show a nice, at least additivity, if not synergy, between TAS-102 and bevacizumab. It showed they can be combined safely. You know, the survival statistics were pretty good. And I think there's a lot of people looking at this to say, well, maybe we could use this as a maintenance regimen even in the first line setting, or could we combine TAS-102 with oxaliplatinum, for instance, so-called TAS-OX, and then use TAS-bevacizumab as a maintenance strategy. So I think you're going to see a lot of studies coming out looking at how we're going to integrate this into earlier lines of therapy.
So I want to talk about a couple of cases that we have here, but also bring in another topic, which is so-called microsatellite status and MSI-high cancers. These are some of the side effects that we're seeing with that study. Incidentally, Philip, are you using this regimen of TAS-102 and Bev?
I have used denominating in 3 patients. I was intrigued by the results because, as you said, when you have things failing, several lines of treatment failed, and you're using TAS-102, there is some benefit, but seeing an added benefit of bevacizumab always is welcome because it doesn't really add much in the way of side effects.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about MSI-high disease, and then we'll get into these specific cases. Well, so maybe you can talk a little bit, first of all, about what MSI is and why we measure it.
Sure. So we have these things called microsatellites, which are these repeats of DNA in our genetic code. Way back in the 90s, they actually picked 5 of these, but it turns out, to define microsatellite instability, it turns out we probably have millions of them. And when you actually look at sequencing studies and things, the major issue is that it's a marker for an inability to properly repair DNA. When I talk to patients about it, I sort of say to them, you know, when you turn off the review function on Microsoft Word, and you're going to get a lot of typos that aren't going to get corrected, it's sort of the same idea. And so instead of having your sort of average of 40 or 50 mutations that most colorectal cancer patients have, these patients have 1,700 mutations. And it's really important for 2 main reasons. First of all, this can be inherited. And if you find a patient with inherited Lynch syndrome or HNPCC, you can save a lot of people in that family because these patients get colorectal cancers, gastric cancers, transitional cell carcinomas, and endometrial cancers. And if they put in proper screening, they could have a normal lifespan. But there are probably millions of Americans, millions of people across the world who have these inherited syndromes who have no idea. And so if you're able to pick up a case and you're with your genetic counseling, when you find one of these patients, you could really impact a ton of patients. The second issue is that these patients seem to have a really nice response to immunotherapy. And the thinking is that because they have 20-fold more mutations, it's easier for the immune system to recognize them as a foreign, you know, entity and to get rid of them in the body. And so Young Lee here, New England Journal of Medicine, just showing the waterfall plot. And as opposed to BRAF, it didn't seem to matter whether you had colorectal or non-colorectal. So these endometrial cancers actually had a very nice response and other mismatch repair deficient. And it's one of the first tumor agnostic approvals by the FDA, which basically said, if you have a mismatch repair deficient cancer, no matter where it comes from, you can use these agents in the second, third line setting. And so it was one of the first approvals in that sense. And the other big thing is if you look at the spider plots, which are kind of the lines showing the CEA or showing the RECIS measurements, the scan measurements, these responses can last seemingly forever, or at least there's many, many patients who stopped after 2 years, for instance, and are still doing well. In Young Lee's original trial, she did that with Luis Diaz, they stopped after 2 years. And those patients are often still doing well. So if you think about the implications, the patient could have a familial syndrome. You could help that patient's cousins, brothers, sisters, parents, and kids. Plus the fact that they'll have this probably a good response to PD-1 or PD-L1 therapy, you can have a huge impact on someone. So the key thing is get it tested. Make sure you're either testing for mismatch repair, which is where they're looking at the proteins, or MSI, which is where you're looking at the length of the DNA repeats.
And just a comment on this graphic, if you notice the green and the gray are the mismatch repair and they go down. So this is a waterfall plot. So if it goes down, each one of these is a separate patient. If it goes down, the tumor is shrinking. If it goes up, it's growing. And you can see given pembrolizumab, most of these cancers, whether colorectal or non-colorectal, did respond in that situation. We're about to see a big paper be presented at the ASCO meeting. It's going to be a virtual meeting this year. But this paper comparing checkpoint inhibitors to chemotherapy up front in patients with this syndrome. And I'm kind of thinking, Philip, that after this paper, maybe people are going to start using pembrolizumab up front. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I have to tell you that I have already started doing that in my practice even before this late-breaking abstract which is going to be presented. There's no question that if you're talking about targeted therapy the way we like it to be, this is the treatment. The side effects are, yes, they can get side effects. Sometimes they can be severe, but overall it's well tolerated. Patients like it. You know, if you're using it every 3 weeks, it's a reasonable treatment. You don't need a port for it. You don't need to carry an infusion bag or take pills for 2 weeks. So all in all, I think it's going to be an interesting treatment for us, for patients who have microsatellite instability. And just to make sure that we understand, the microsatellite instability patients or the patients who have mismatch repair, they can be Lynch syndrome, but they can also be what we call somatic mutation, that the patient doesn't really carry a gene that will pass on to anybody. And there's a distinction we can make for those patients, how we know that. So yes, this is a treatment that at least I will be continuing to use as a frontline. Maybe some patients I wouldn't, but I would say in my average patient, I will, and I would like to hear what Wells thinks.
Well, I'm going to guess that Wells is going to say the same thing, but we're going to move on anyhow so we can not let you guys get off on a tangent here. That's going to be a great paper to talk about, but
I'll
let's
send you
stay
a text,
on target
Philip.
Here. Yeah, it seemed like it should have been yesterday that this would have been done, but thankfully we have a trial now to prove it. You know, we talked about the fact that this is rounds. We're not going to be able to, we're just kind of doing a little tasting menu here. There are a lot of great things in the slide deck you should take a look into, including this case that Tammy had of a patient with MSI high. You can take a look at these scans and see how the patient responded. And there's a great slide in there that Tammy put together about some of the things to consider with patient education. But I want to move on to this case. And Melanie, this is a young woman, 52 years old grandma who presented in 2015, and I think really typifies what a lot of patients with metastatic colon cancer, most of them don't have MSI, so you don't see this kind of great story, don't necessarily have a BRAF mutation so they can respond to targeted therapy. This lady seems like she kind of went through a more typical course. Melanie, can you talk about, I guess she started out in 2015, what was going on at that point?
Sure, and I'll be brief. I know we're cutting on time, but this is a longtime patient of Dr. Messersmith. She was diagnosed in January of 2015, metastatic, had a lot of disease burden, ovarian mets, pelvic mets, and then a huge mass in addition to liver mets. So she did go through sort of the traditional course of therapy. It started out with CAPOX, and then bevacizumab was added in, and went through numerous cycles of that, went to CAPOX, and then ended up on the FOLFIRI panitumumab. And she was on that, I believe, for almost 2 years. So she did really well with this therapy, given the length of time that she was on it. You can see the electrolyte insufficiencies that we noted, because in our clinic, we started to sort of see this trend with panitumumab, especially long-term, that she would basically have to receive potassium magnesium infusions with every chemotherapy treatment. Struggled a lot with the typical side effects of FOLFIRI and panitumumab, rash certainly, fatigue, diarrhea at times. But overall, in the 2 years she received this therapy, really tolerated it well. She subsequently had to have a pretty invasive surgery because she started to have a bleed, and that was resected, but she had a pretty big surgery, in 2019, and was then resected and then put on TAS-102 after that.
So can you talk a little bit about what happened when she went on the TAS-102 and how she did?
So she went on it initially. They started her around 60 milligrams was her dose. And she, just being primarily a very active woman, I mean, she's young, she does have a huge family, not working, but really struggled and has struggled with fatigue as her primary complaint, not wanting to do a lot, staying at home, not getting out. You know, I would encourage walks with her, kind of just for her mental and emotional state, which I think was also contributing to some of the fatigue. I mean, this woman has been through years of therapy, and really this is going to be what she deals with for the rest of her life. So fatigue being the primary one, she did have neutropenia with TAS-102, and there was dose reductions and then a schedule modification that Dr. Messersmith did, and then the typical diarrhea as well.
So maybe, Wells, you can reflect a little bit upon this patient's course, and I guess also why you used an EGFR antibody. She actually seemed like she did really well on it. What led to that decision based on the sidedness and her tumor biomarkers? And maybe comment a little bit about what happened when she got TAS-102.
Sure. So one of the key things I'm looking for when I'm trying to decide whether to use an EGFR inhibitor, because as Melanie and other people have talked about, you know, they do have their side effects. You can get rash, electrolyte abnormalities, et cetera. So the issue for her was that she was very symptomatic. She had these abdominal lesions. She had pain. And so for her, shrinking the tumor actually had a major quality of life impact. And there are other patients where they don't have any symptoms whatsoever. And shrinking a tumor might make the scan look pretty, but you know, it's not necessarily going to change how they feel. And so in that case, I might wait a little while to use an EGFR inhibitor because a response isn't really going to buy me much. Her case, though, really bad abdominal pain. And the abdominal pain pretty much resolved once we got this thing shrunken down. And then she's pretty much my world record on FOLFIRI and panitumumab. I don't know that I've ever had someone on it that long. When we have someone on for these long term, we certainly encourage them to take an extra week off here and there. And I always tell people, you can take a week off on your terms when you're visiting family, or you can just wait until you're neutropenic or something where we can't give it to you. So we encourage people to sort of have those extra week offs planned and to do something fun, you know, while they're feeling good and feeling up to it. And then with Tess, what was interesting with her was she just felt like she got hit by a ton of bricks on day 5. And so what I did, instead of doing the package insert 5 mg/m² dose reduction per dose, what Melanie and I decided to do, and by the way, Melanie's the one doing much of the work here. I'm sort of focusing on new patients and scan reviews, and folks like Melanie and Tammy are handling a lot of these side effects. But what we decided to do is drop the day 5 and the day 12, which ends up being about a 20% dose reduction, but you're changing the schedule. It's not in the package insert, I should note, but it really helped her for whatever reason. It seemed to just smooth out that crushing fatigue that some people get shortly after day 5, day 6, day 7. And so for her, she did very well. And actually, I just saw her last week and she's still on TAS-102 with that altered schedule and is doing fine. Just saw her kids.
Any comments about, you know, the two drugs in this sort of space, so to speak, that are considered are regorafenib and TAS-102? When we survey people, we hear that in general, TAS-102, yes, it has a paper toxicity of neutropenia, but is relatively well tolerated. Regorafenib, depending upon the dose, can be a problem. How do you decide, Wells, which one to go with first?
Yeah, that's difficult. Some of our clinical trials, so a lot of times, especially with a lot of interesting immune therapy trials coming down the pike for colorectal, I'm looking ahead and trying to figure out, okay, how many lines of therapy do I need? Do they want us to have used one of these drugs beforehand? And is the immunotherapy going to include a TKI? Because there's some very interesting data on some of these TKIs combined with immune therapy. And so if I'm thinking about that as a trial, I'm certainly going to go to TAS 102 in that case first. What I often will do for folks is actually, and I just saw someone earlier today, it's why I'm wearing scrubs, because I don't wear a shirt and a tie anymore. We consider ties to be germ sticks at this point. So we're really just have altered our, you know, what we're wearing. And thank God these have large waist strings, because this is from 1998. You know, I just saw someone earlier today, and to be honest, sometimes I'll do both. I do think we can't underestimate the financial toxicity of pills for some people, because if their deductible just reset, they might have a $2,000 bill waiting for them when they go to the pharmacy, or often these drugs are sent. So I'll often write a TAS 102 prescription to say, okay, that's, you know, maybe plan B, and plan A, we're going to look for some trials and kind of start to work on both things at the same time and figure out what the financial implications and other things. And the nice thing is when you use a conventional agent, you don't have a washout period. You don't have to do screening. You don't have to do this, that, the other thing. You can start it, you know, tomorrow if you need to. And on the other hand, with a study, it might be worth waiting next extra week or two just to see if you can do the study. So sometimes we're kind of doing both things. Regorafenib versus TAS 102, boy, that's tough. You know, certainly if you treat full dose regorafenib right from the get-go, you're going to blow a lot of patients out of the water and they're not going to want to retry it because of the toxicities. If you work your way up, and I know you have a slide on the redose trial, they tend to seem to do a little bit better. So that's an impact as well.
And I highly recommend that you check out those slides on the redose, though, that we just flipped through, because there's tons of great stuff in the slide set. But let's finish out talking a little bit about metastatic gastric cancer. Again, a little bit of a tasting menu. And actually, Phil has a pretty cool case that he's going to present of a new approach. But we want to talk a little bit about, first of all, MSI again, because, you know, you do see MSI high in gastric cancer and PD-L1 level, which we haven't talked about much today, but intermittently we'll be talking about, particularly when we get to our lung cancer programs. And then, interestingly, HER2, we did breast cancer on Tuesday night. Of course, we spent half the time talking about HER2-positive breast cancer. One comment, maybe just to go back to Tammy about the second-line therapy. FOLFOX is often used first-line. But when we survey people right now, the most common second-line therapy that's utilized is ramucirumab, again, an anti-angiogenic, with chemotherapy, specifically paclitaxel. Just kind of curious, Tammy, what kind of issues you run into with that combination in terms of tolerability, safety?
Neuropathy is the biggest issue and could sometimes even prevent us from even using a taxane second line, depending on how severe their neuropathy is from FOLFOX and how much FOLFOX they actually got. So I think that's probably the biggest issue with that second line, you know, a neurotoxic agent followed by a neurotoxic agent.
Wells, what about checkpoint inhibitors in metastatic gastroesophageal cancer? This is where PD-1 starts to come in. And can you talk a little bit about how you approach an esophageal cancer as opposed to a gastric cancer?
Absolutely. So it's hard to keep up with these studies because, first of all, nowadays they all have the same name and you just have to look at the number and kind of figure out what's going on. But one of the key things with gastroesophageal, you got to figure out, is it squamous cell or adeno? Because if it's squamous and the CPS score is greater than 10, you can use it second line. Adeno, you tend to use third line and above. There's some trials coming out in this CPS score greater than 1. So those are a little bit different. CPS score is a way of monitoring or checking PD-L1 staining, not just on the tumor cells, but on the stromal cells and macrophages and things that are actually in there. That's why it's called combined. Just remember the C is combined. And so that'll remind you that it's not just the tumor cells they're looking at. They're actually looking at other cells as well. And so if you have a CPS score greater than 10 in pretty much any subset analysis you see in gastroesophageal cancer and a PD-1 therapy, you're going to find a much more of a benefit. So that's why for squamous cell, on the label, CPS greater than or equal to 10%. On the label for adeno, it's greater or equal than 1%. If you see a CPS greater than 10, you're going to have more of a benefit. So if you're trying to weigh two different options, if you're thinking about Taxol, Ramucirumab, or some other agent, but the CPS score is quite high, that's definitely going to make me think more of immunotherapy. If it's fairly low, if it's just barely 1%, probably not going to get quite that same benefit. Still labeled, but you might think about some other agents too. So that's kind of how I think about it as I separate these two. Squamous versus adeno, CPS score. And if it's high, that's good for immunotherapy. You're going to want to think about immunotherapy in that situation.
Just kind of curious, Philip, whether you've seen patients with metastatic gastric cancer have useful benefit from checkpoint inhibitor. Of course, some of them will have MSI high disease, and we know those people respond. But the ones who don't have MS stable, so to speak, Philip, where we start looking at PD-L1 levels, do you see effective responses? Do you see some patients who do well for a couple of years, for example?
I personally haven't seen the couple of years yet, but I've seen patients who've been on it for many months, exceeding a year maybe, but I haven't really seen enough of the patients who I would say, yeah, I can see the 2 years in this situation. However, I've seen patients who stabilize, I've seen patients who respond, but I see patients who can be on it also a long time.
So, Philip, we're going to talk in our lung cancer program about the fact that right now with lung cancer, the standard first-line treatment is chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor. They think about PD-1 as part of that decision. That's true of squamous, non-squamous, and now small cell. They all are getting checkpoint plus chemo. What about that kind of strategy? And we know we give chemo up front. What about that kind of strategy with gastric cancer, Philip?
Well, that has been tested in a randomized trial. And unfortunately, adding it to this standard chemotherapy didn't really work. It didn't add anything. So at this point in time, in gastric cancer, unlike the cancers you mentioned, we do not use the combination in the frontline. So we don't use combo of chemo plus immunotherapy in gastric cancer at all.
So, Wells, we were talking about TAS-102 and colorectal cancer, and all of a sudden we saw a study and then actually an FDA approval of TAS-102 in metastatic gastric cancer. Any comments on this, Wells? Is this a strategy that you started to use?
Yeah, I have used it. And, it's very similar to colon. It's not a home run. It's more of a single or a double in terms of how it's changing outcomes. The curves don't really flatten. They kind of mirror each other. The hazard ratio, again, is 0.69. So that means you got about a 31% improvement. And this is overall survival. So it's another tool in the toolbox. It's often well tolerated. Sometimes late in the course, patients with gastroesophageal cancer have problems with pills. So you have to think about that a little bit. But I use it kind of similar to the way that I do for colorectal cancer.
So we're going to finish out with one case, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about COVID if we can. But actually, Philip, this is a patient from your practice who actually got TAS-102 with metastatic gastric cancer. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what happened with this woman. It looks like we were talking about the usual sequence of therapies, and it kind of looks like she went through that. Maybe you can go through this case, Philip.
So the patient was HER2 negative. So that's a mandatory test we do on every patient with stage 4 disease. And the patient had good performance status. We gave her FOLFOX, but she had the problem with the neuropathy, which was starting to get worse, and also fatigue. And that could be related to her longstanding diabetes also, which puts her at risk. So that's why when we went to the second line, we could not really add the Taxol. At the same time, doing the CPS score wasn't really encouraging to go into immunotherapy, either second line or third line. So we gave her ramucirumab alone. We got a bit of a stable disease, and it was well tolerated, except for the blood pressure a bit elevated. And then once she got to the third line, she was actually having performance status 2. At that point in time, we had a couple of options. One was to put her through chemotherapy again, which would be irinotecan, single agent, or combination like FOLFIRI, or go for a lesser toxic treatment, which was the single agent TAS-102. And she got it. And in fact, she had stable disease on it. That's why I wanted to highlight that these drugs can work. There's a possibility of keeping the disease stable. And for a third line, I think not going through chemotherapy, but rather a treatment that can keep it steady, it was reasonable to continue with it. However, she also started to get problems with fatigue. And with the neutropenia, we decided to cut down on the dose a bit. so that she can stay on it. The key point to make here is that the neutropenia is not really dangerous, as I mentioned to you before, like we see, for example, for Firi. But at the same time, you have to take the patient totality, and we treat the patient. They have some fatigue, so you make a decision with that in mind. And the other thing is that dose reductions sometimes work well in favor of the patient because it means that the patient can stay on the treatment for longer, and that's really what matters. If the patient starts to get a lot of side effects, they may refuse the treatment, or you might decide not to take the treatment. So one has to be really very personalized in the way we approach the patients, and patients have to be working with the doctor, the nurses, the nurse practitioners, PAs, everybody, to really come up with a good way of maintaining the patient in a way that can control the disease.
So I see in the chat room, someone said that they missed the beginning. And are we going to be posting this? And yes, all this is what we're going to be posting. Actually, we have a whole lot of other stuff. We're going to be posting like 40 hours of video over the next few weeks. And just stay tuned as we keep in touch with you about that. Just want to take a last couple of minutes and just sort of, we had a survey. I'm going to share it with you as we go through these next few meetings. And if you have some questions, we can add to it. So shoot us an email if you want to, if you have a question you'd like us to put in the survey. But Tammy, here are a couple of things that we put in the survey. Maybe I'll just ask you to comment on them. We've been asking people all over the country and all different tumor types how COVID has affected clinical practice. And I think what we're seeing here, which is answers from all over the country, is kind of typical what we're seeing. So one question we ask, we hear a lot about, particularly in places like New York, where there's a real crunch on resources, that, you know, basic cancer treatments such as surgery and radiation therapy in some cases have been delayed for long periods of time. And you can see here that in both of those things has occurred to a moderate extent, at least in the people answering this. This is, of course, maybe the most dramatic change in medicine in general and oncology. I saw an article in the New York Times that said we went through 10 years of change in 1 week, which is the use of telemedicine. And we could spend an entire hour talking about it. But you can see here our respondents in general. Well, actually, it's interesting that actually a quarter of them were using some kind of telemedicine before. We usually get a much lower answer, but almost everybody is now. And there's a lot we could talk about as it relates to that. Tammy, we'll show you some more results of this as we go through this series, including Tuesday night when we do lymphoma. But just, I'm just curious, Tammy, what your experience has been with telemedicine. It's new for a lot of people. What do you see as the positives and the negatives?
So yeah, prior to this, I was not doing any telemedicine, and overnight I was doing full patient schedules. I certainly don't like sitting at a table for my 8-hour clinic day. I miss running from room to room, actually. But I think for patients that I'm able to do video visits, I feel like the quality of care, I'm still able to connect with them, getting them used to how to hold their camera to show me certain side effects gets to be interesting. For patients who don't have access to a smartphone or internet, doing phone visits, I find those are more challenging. Those are a little bit more difficult, especially for those poor historian patients. So I have found that that has been a little bit more challenging. But I think overall, my patients have had a really good response to this change in care and still feel connected and in touch with us.
So one final comment. I'm curious, Wells, you know, one of the things that I've been wondering about is hopefully we get through this whole thing and come out the other end back where we were before. But, you know, whether telemedicine to some extent is going to remain, hopefully to some extent. But what I'm curious about specifically, Wells, is the potential for telemedicine to assist in terms of clinical research. Because there are a lot of patients who don't want to travel to tertiary centers. And if you could actually execute trials, we already showed examples. You have this man with this incredible response who was on a trial of atezo-bev. Do you think that maybe moving forward, Wells, we might be able to use telemedicine to get more people into trials?
Yeah, I think it's an incredible opportunity. And like Tammy, I'm doing probably half my clinic visits are telemedicine. And remember, you know, Melanie is a native Coloradan. There's not many of them. But out here, we treat people from Wyoming, Montana, Kansas, Western Nebraska, New Mexico. These people are driving 6 hours for sort of a tox check. It's crazy. So being able to have local labs and then having that one-on-one interaction with the patient. We also have Share My Screen technology, so we can show them scans, we can trend out all their labs. It's been incredible. And unfortunately, of course, at this point, we're just racking up deviations. And it's interesting, the companies are having us start each deviation with COVID-19, blah, 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 COVID-19, blah, 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 because there's just so many deviations across research. But, you know, the FDA put out guidance, the NCI put out guidance. It's kind of a forgiveness period. But I hope that we don't go back to making people drive 6 hours for just a standard sort of side effect check or something that's pretty straightforward. So there's a lot of things where, I mean, I don't wish this COVID thing whatsoever, but it has accelerated some changes, which may at the end of the day be good.
So thanks so much to the faculty, and thanks to all the attendees for participating.